The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Tim is away this week. As Brian and I head for the Recumbent CycleCon and Bicycle Touring and Travel Expo in Sharonville, Ohio, which is just north of Cincinnati this weekend, I was pondering how the manufacturers and dealers who are going to be attending the show are coping with the ever-changing retail landscape. So there's the internet, along with ginormous online retailers such as Amazon and eBay, and they have forever altered the way we look at and think about buying goods and even some services. So instead of the face-to-face experience, millions of consumers are opting for the faceless pages online. They're replete with hundreds, if not thousands, of consumer reviews to make their purchasing decisions. So you can often go to a place like Amazon.com, click on a product, see the reviews, and who knows if that person is really telling the truth, but people rely on that to make purchasing decisions. So what happens when a small independent guy decides to launch a new brand? And that's what we're going to find out this evening. We meet Neil Flock. I've known him for many years. His company is Cycle Monkey, and he's launching a new brand called Link Bicycles. He always represented roll-off speed hubs. So that is the brilliantly designed 14-speed internally geared system. It became the king of its category. It is not an inexpensive option, but it is such a seamless option. It's got a huge range of gears, and it is pretty much maintenance-free. Neil's company, Cycle Monkey, repaired those hubs. He offered all the spare parts. He built wheels using roll-off, and then more and more items started showing up on his site. This year, Neil came to Interbike with his own brand of internally geared carbon drive bicycles called the Link brand. The concept is very simple. It's elegant. So I wanted to ask Neil about his new bikes and how a small guy like Link Bicycles can make headway in a world of giants and treks. So after we talk to Neil, and we do a few news items, including a very cheerful update on Shelley Snyder and the continued outpouring of love and support she's receiving, we're going to head on out to Massachusetts and speak with Dr. Michael Charney. Now retired from private practice, Michael decided to plunge headfirst into the murky pool of bicycle advocacy. And what he found was a straight line to an old idea that he hopes is going to take root in the U.S., dubbed the Dutch Reach. Michael explains how this simple procedure of opening your car door, whether a driver or a passenger, can save lives and change our behavior. All right, so off we go. We're heading to Colorado Springs. We're going to speak with Neil Flock from Cycle Monkey and Link Bicycles. Neil, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So I know you are not exactly home and not exactly in Sharonville, so somewhere in Colorado.
That's correct. I was at Interbike and then Outerbike in Moab and stopped to see the in-laws in Colorado, and we're heading over to the show in Cincinnati on Friday.
Very cool. Well, I get to have you as a captive guest tonight. Tell me a little bit, or tell us, I should say, our listeners, a little bit about yourself and how you got into the bike business.
Yeah. I don't know. I just started riding bikes as a kid. I started working in bike shops at about age 13 as a mechanic, and did that on and off through college. And again, when we moved to California, and then took a job with the former Roll-Off USA office for a couple years, and started Cycle Monkey on the side as a custom wheel building and suspension repair business, and then start absorbing. I absorbed Roloff's as a distributor and U.S. Service Center, and then over the years I've added more brands that we distribute and grown Cycle Monkey to where we now have, it's pretty much evenly split between the consumer side and the dealer side and small builders.
Which is interesting because you have a unique perspective, one that a lot of other people don't have, that you do get to deal with consumers and you do get to deal with shops. So that's kind of interesting. And you do some esoteric stuff. Explain exactly how the Roloff hub and work with Roloff, how that has sort of led to this new enterprise of yours.
Yeah, so I got my first speed hub in 2003, and I built a bike around one at a shop in Germany when I was 18, so it was 98. And have been riding Roloff since 03. Pretty much every day I'm on a Roloff bike and really appreciate that I never think about whether the bike's going to work. And definitely grown Cycle Monkey around that concept of these really reliable bikes, mostly focused on Roloff. But not everybody can justify the cost of the speed hub. And we've seen a fair amount of interest in the type of bikes that we normally sell with Roloff, but they're inaccessible. So the link concept is to make a very low maintenance, durable, you know, easy to ride bike that will be available in multiple price levels and ideally reach a wider audience.
So the Link brand was introduced at Interbike?
Yeah, we did a preview to get some feedback. We are planning to do a Kickstarter campaign in a couple of months, place our initial order right end of the year, beginning of the year, and have the first delivery starting in the spring.
I looked at the website, and I think that the concept is really not only interesting, I think it's appropriate and timely. Explain what the different combinations are. So you make a mixty, a cross, and a road. That's what you're showing on the site. But explain where they start, and then obviously the high end is a Roloff hub, but you have other options.
Right. So I have a lot of background with building custom bikes, predominantly because the Roloff system is not available in the U.S. as part of a complete bike. And I've always gravitated towards that idea of building exactly the right bike for the given rider. Of course, that ends up pushing the price up quite a bit. So we are offering consumers a nice range of options. I don't think it's too crazy, but you would start the selection process by choosing one of those three frame styles, and they all come in five sizes, X small, small, medium, large, X large. Each will be available in two colors. And then you'll choose whether you want a flat bar, an urban bar, or a drop bar. And component colors, you can choose black parts or silver parts. And then for the rear wheel, you get to choose a single speed, a three speed, 8-speed, or the 14-speed Roloff option. And then the crank set, standard single-speed crank, or the 2-speed Schlumpf system. And then there'll be an option for a dynamo and dynamo-powered light package, a rack and fenders, and that should be it. So
sounds like plenty. So all your bikes are showing disc. Is that the only option? It's going to be just disc brake?
Disc only. I don't see any reason why you'd want to choose a rim brake. I was an early adopter of disc brakes back in the mid-90s because when mountain biking, when the rim brakes get wet, the brake power basically goes down by 50 or 80%.
Yeah, so we're really looking at a utilitarian type bike. Are you expecting people to race any of these bikes, maybe the cross bike?
If they want to, we have no focus on competitive use. We're looking for bikes that are fun, easy to use, and give you as much riding time as possible and not require constant maintenance.
And they all use belt drive?
Yeah, that's the only way we'll sell them. Of course, any belt frame could have a chain if someone so desired. But
yeah,
we've been selling the Gates carbon drive system since 2010 when they first released the roll-off version of the product. And once you've gotten getting used to having a shifting system that you never need to adjust, then the occasional chain maintenance gets kind of annoying because it's something you have to do at some interval. And with the gate system, you just go and ride it. You don't worry about it. There's no lubrication, no cleaning. So I think that's a perfect pairing with the internal system.
What's the tire size going to be in terms of small to, or I should say narrow to wide? How wide, how narrow can you go? And obviously you're building these wheels, right?
Yeah. So the frames will be manufactured and painted in Taiwan, and then we will do the actual bike assembly in California to accommodate those different combinations that people can order. The wheels are included in that. They'll be, right now, they'll be hand-built. If we can get the volume up, then I will be buying a robot and a very sophisticated robot that will build them the same quality that a human does.
Because fenders are an option, so I'm assuming that, oh, well, with disc, I guess it doesn't matter too much. You could just go as wide as you want, as wide as the fork and stays can handle, right?
Yeah, so the frames have road frame max clearance 32 millimeter, mixed in cross 45 millimeter. We will ship the bikes with tires that are 3 millimeters. Actually, it's a 28 on the road bike and a 42 on the cross and mixed, so that the fender could be there or not. If the user wanted a wider tire, they could swap them later. But tire choice is not one of the options for the on the menu.
I want to ask you a few things that actually don't have anything to do with the bike itself, and then we'll get back to the bike.
Sure.
How were the bikes received at Interbike? What was the feedback you got about this concept? Because it's a concept that Brian and I have talked about a lot, this idea of a small, very targeted, well-manufactured, but not real expensive bicycle that has kind of the options you have. It's something that I think is right up the consumer's alley. But tell me what your feedback was when you got to Interbike.
I got a lot of positive feedback from both acquaintances in the industry and dealers that stopped by the booth. Of course, it was the dealers that were interested in the bike already are working with commuting or touring bikes and appreciated what type of bike it was. We also had Syntex at the booth, and they do, you know, road and mountain bike high-end components. And so some of the booth visitors didn't take note of the Link bikes and were more focused on the Syntex product. But the dealers that did appreciate that type of bike had good feedback that I hit a lot of the design elements or details that would be important for the urban user or the that type of bike.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Neil Flock. He is somewhere between here and there on his way to Sharonville to the Recumbent CycleCon and Bicycle Touring and Travel Expo. We will be seeing him this weekend. His business is Cycle Monkey and Link Bicycles, and we're talking about the bicycles because they're new. They are not yet produced. How difficult do you think it is to break into the bicycle market as a manufacturer, even at the level you're doing it? I mean, obviously, you've got the Giants and the Treks and the Mammoth people, but, you know, you're targeting a fairly big market. I mean, that market could be considered quite huge, and yet not a lot of people are addressing it.
Right. So these types of bikes are the number one category in Europe, and because there's a culture of using bikes for transportation, especially in Germany, Netherlands, Belgium. And we're seeing growth in various parts of the U.S., especially over the last decade, more and more bike lanes, the bike share programs that are being put in are really, in my mind, helping people view the bike as not just a toy or a piece of sporting equipment, but as a vehicle and something that can get them to point A to point B without needing special clothing or, you know, training. It's easy. It's convenient. So I think it's definitely tough to break into the industry. Yeah, certainly I have an uphill battle trying to get an expensive gear hub into shops. But I do have an established dealer network and also our consumer network where we have a little bit of advantage. We can, you know, rely on some of the dealers to sign up and floor some of the bikes initially. And we have a pretty dedicated consumer network where they maybe they want that as a spare bike and they keep their roll-off bike for special occasions. Well, I mean, not special occasions, but maybe the link is better when there's more of a theft risk or shorter trips. And they probably have friends that might want that roll-off bike that the customer already has, but aren't able to afford it. If I was doing this just from scratch without having a history of working with shops and consumers, I think it would be significantly more difficult to find any traction.
Yeah. So you are going to be able to offer the Link bicycles at the shop level?
Correct.
Huh. That should be interesting. So do you think that the state of the industry is healthy? Do you think that the bicycle industry as a whole is healthy?
I'm not sure. Last year was pretty rough for us especially, and just about everybody I've talked to. I don't think it's going to disappear by any means, but I think it's in the midst of kind of restructure and trying to figure out where e-commerce fits in and where the brick and mortar fits in and how the manufacturer deals with the different supply chains. There's also a lot of maybe an abundance, an overabundance of options for the consumer right now, but not in the type of bike that we're making. So they will have maybe too many commuter bike type options, but none that, or very limited options that are as easy to use as maintenance free.
Let's take Surly, for example. They made a fat bike, and yep. It sort of caught on. All of a sudden, everybody made fat bikes, and Surly pretty much disappeared from the market. Is that something that you see as a possibility, that here you've got these Link bikes, which are really simple and elegant and useful, and somebody might come along and say, "Ooh, I like that category, and I'm going to just squash them"? I mean, that's a horrible question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
I don't know that I would agree that Surly disappeared from the fat bike market. They certainly rode the wave to the peak, and then we're beyond we're beyond the height of fat bikes, and so they've scaled back their models. But, I mean, they've made millions and millions of dollars off fat bikes and continue to offer where they have two options now. And, I mean, they're very well established in the fat bike world. And then they created the plus tire category. They have a full catalog of products. So I certainly have several more models planned that'll follow these initial models that are very urban focused. So I'm not worried about that.
Okay. That's a great answer. I like it because I guess, you know, not being in retail anymore, I don't have quite the finger on that pulse that I did at one point. And so I have to sort of rely on people like you to fill me in, even though I could do more and more research. It's just, you know, there are only so many hours each week. So these bikes are not yet available. You are going to have a Kickstarter program. Once you have your frames in stock, and I imagine that's where you have to have your frame sets, obviously. How long will it take you from order to build to ship to me? Are we looking at a week, 2 weeks?
My goal is to be able to maintain a 1 to 2 week window from order to shipping from California.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. A really good idea. Wow. So what are you bringing to Sharonville, to the recumbent and touring show?
So I do have the three link samples that are shown in the photos on the website.
Nice.
And then I've got a variety of two-touron bikes. They do high-end touring and commuting bikes. So we've got some of each. The two-touron bikes have roll-off and pinion, drop bar, flat bar, kind of a mix. And the link bikes, there's one roll-off, one Alphine, and one single speed with the Schlumpf crankset option.
Well, I think you're going to fit right in at this show. It is very enthusiastic, consumer-oriented. So when we were there last year, I mean, people showed up with helmets, you know, and they were there to ride and to test ride and to look and to act. I think they went home and bought. I mean, I really think it was a very well received show. So I hope you enjoy it when you get there. How can people find out more about your Link bicycles and about the other things that you do?
So we have a website, linkbicycles.com, and then there's an associated Facebook page, which will have more frequent updates. And we also have the Cycle Monkey website that's very dated, but soon to be replaced with a newer version. And the Cycle Monkey Facebook and Instagram and Twitter accounts get regular postings.
So when do you think you'll launch your Kickstarter?
Seeing as I'm on the road until the middle of November, we're looking at late November for I've got to finish the video when I get home, and then we'll get the campaign started.
You know, we wish you a lot of luck. I mean, I always enjoyed it because when I went to Interbike, you would come to my yoga classes. You would actually get your butt out of bed early and come to yoga. So I kind of miss that. But it'll be nice to see you this weekend in Cincinnati. And good luck with the Link bicycles. Good luck with everything. We'll talk again.
Thank you. We'll see you this weekend.
All right. Have a great trip. Stay safe.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye-bye. Neil Flock joined me. He's in Colorado Springs packing up, getting ready to come to the Recumbent CycleCon Bicycle Touring and Travel Expo in Sharonville this weekend. We will take a quick break. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Beginning on Wednesday, October 19th and running through Sunday, October 23rd, City Music, Cleveland's Chamber Orchestra, presents its first concert performances of the 2016-2017 season. Conducted by Avner Dorman and featuring soloist Sayaka Shoji, City Music is in its 13th season of bringing classical music to Greater Cleveland with free performances in Lakewood, Collinwood, Beechwood, Slavic Village, and Willoughby Hills. For performance schedules and locations, go to citymusiccleveland.org.
Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, and as promised, I have a few news items. Here is an update on what has become our Shelley. So Shelley Snyder has been embraced by just about everyone who hears her story as our Shelley. This week, Tim Lally, a local Chevrolet dealer, offered to match donations dollar for dollar, sending Shelley's GoFundMe campaign over the $90,000 mark. Health-wise, she's been taken off the ventilator, is breathing on her own. She's getting bedside physical therapy, and someone even gave her a pedicure this week, although I understand she may not be happy with that. Some of the crazy things, and crazy in a good way, that have happened include the folks at Critical Mass Cleveland convincing the owners of our terminal tower downtown to turn the tower pink in honor of Shelley at last Friday's Critical Mass ride, along with the myriad of other foodie fundraisers, because in Cleveland, everything has to do with food. At least two T-shirts have been designed and produced. All the proceeds are going to Shelley's medical fund. For more information on Shelley and how she is doing, it's GoFundMe.com. One small addendum. Evidently, the people in Kalispell, Montana, where Shelley was in hospital for almost 2 weeks, probably a week and a half before they brought her home, are feeling bereft and left out. And they have some sort of a fundraiser going on in Montana a ride coming up. So you can go, as I said, to GoFundMe.com and search Shelley Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R. Along the same lines of fundraising, only this is for a very healthy organization. You might remember that the Yahoo Employee Fund approved a $50,000 grant for World Bicycle Relief last year for Carlos Perea. Well, he applied for the grant again this year, and Yahoo had increased the amount that was available to $75,000, and it was approved this week. All the money will go toward bicycles for education in Zambia. It's 500-plus bicycles. As Carlos says on his Facebook page, thousands of lives changed, thousands of smiling faces. I'm so excited that I'm shaking. He is still saying you can participate in World Bicycle Relief. You can go to teamwbr.worldbicyclerelief.org/Carlos if you are interested in helping increase that $75,000 grant this year. So there is a tweet from Derek Bouchard Hall, who is the head of USA Cycling, and he is offering, along with ASOS, some Team USA Rio autographed jerseys in a sweepstakes. Here's the info. It says, with the medals presented, history written, and the championships crowned at the Rio Olympics, we are offering you an exclusive chance to win your own part of the Olympic dream. To celebrate our partnership with USA Cycling, we've got three super exclusive replica USA Cycling jerseys, which have been signed by their Olympians. With only three lucky winners receiving a piece of Olympic cycling history, make sure you sign up by October 10th, not to miss out. There are two autographed jerseys size small, one autographed jersey size medium. You can go to ASOS.com/EN/USA Cycling Sweepstakes. So this comes from my favorite, as you know, online wire. Every single day. I don't know where they get all this information. It comes from Endurance Sports Wire. And this is about triathlons, dates and locations announced for the 2017 National Championship slate. Comes from Colorado Springs. The dates and locations for nearly all of the 2017 USA Triathlon National Championships are set, allowing amateur multi-sport athletes to mark their calendars for opportunities to earn national titles and world championship team spots at a variety of distances and disciplines across the U.S. The season runs from January 29th through November 12th, with the Winter Triathlon National Championships held in conjunction with the King Boreas Winter Triathlon kicking off the 2017 season. Long course duathlon nationals will head to Cary, North Carolina on April 29th, followed by off-road triathlon nationals in Arkadelphia, Arkansas on June 4th. Also in June, the Clydesdale and Athena National Championships return to Grand Rapids, Michigan on June 11th. And this is kind of cool. We've got one right in our area. New in 17 will be the Ultra Distance Triathlon National Championships held on September 10th in Sandusky, Ohio as part of the Rev 3 Cedar Point. So Cedar Point is a huge amusement park here in Northeast Ohio. It is up on the lake about 75 miles from Cleveland. We actually used to do a ride there. Our MS-150 ride used to come from Cleveland to Sandusky at Cedar Point. You'd stay overnight and ride back the next day. So that's going to be interesting. I don't know how long the ultra distance is, but I guess we'll find out. So for more information, you can go to usatriathlon.org and just look up all of these dates and events for 2017. So this comes from Velo News, and it's kind of interesting. After talking with Jeremy Powers last week, we talked a lot about his Jam Fund and how it helps young riders get into the sport and take some of the pressure off of them for everything from money to how to perform. And so Velo News this week actually has an article titled, "This American Ex-Pro Could Reshape How Rider Agents Operate." So I guess I never really thought about whether cyclists have agents, but I guess maybe they do, just like every other athlete and musician. This is by Fred Dreyer. It was published October 5th, as I said, in Velo News. It starts out, Caleb and Alex Fairley are seated in a suburban Salt Lake City Starbucks across from the parents of their newest client, Nielsen Paulus. Nearby, a handful of cycling fans chat about the upcoming Tour of Utah stage, unaware that the future of the next great American cyclist is being planned at the adjacent table. Jack and Jeanette Paulus are concerned. During the previous day's stage, Nielsen suffered four mechanicals before the peloton even reached the base of the day's climb up Mount Nebo. He was able to claw his way back to a 12-man group of riders near the front, but finished 3:57 down to stage winner Lachlan Morton and his Axion Haggis Berman teammate Adrian Costa. Alex Fairley assures the Paulus family that the flub will not hurt Nielsen's standing within professional cycling's fickle labor market. Nielsen has plenty of time to show his value, Alex says. Caleb sits silently, listening to his father offer assurances. Just 4 months ago, Caleb retired from his own professional cycling career to launch an agency alongside his father, who is one of the country's most powerful insurance brokers in the sports and entertainment world. The Fairleys reason that Caleb's cycling knowledge, when matched with Alex's business experience, will create a business that can thrive in cycling's unpredictable market for athlete representation. Finally, Caleb speaks. We had a phone call and Nielsen sounded frustrated, Caleb says. I told him, dude, you're perfect. If you were as good as Costa today, I'd be worried. I'd rather you be that good at the Tour d'Avenir. A top finish at that famed French U23 race is part of the Fairleys' grand plan for Paulus' professional career. The 20-year-old will stay with Axion in the American domestic scene for another year and build his confidence at the smaller events before stepping into the leagues. Evidently, this father-son organization has a new agency for cyclists. It'll be interesting to see how well that does and who they sign over the next few years. If you'd like to read the whole article, it is in the online Velo News, which is really, it's velonews.competitor.com by Fred Dreyer, published October 5th. So this one's about women cycling, which, you know, we talk about that as often as we can. Trek's new advocate program aims to get more women cycling, leading rides, running events, growing the market. This comes from BikeRadar.com. Trek Bicycles launched its new advocate program at the inaugural Trek Women's Summit in September 2016 with 54 women from across the U.S. and Canada. These women will be leading rides, running events, and helping make bike shops more inviting for female customers. But this isn't your average ambassadors program. The advocates will also have the potential to influence how Trek design and make products for women in the future. The summit, which took place at Trek headquarters in Waterloo, Wisconsin, involved talks, factory tours, and feedback sessions, with the women in attendance also receiving training in event organization, social media, and more. Trek is the latest brand to take direct action to grow female participation in cycling at a grassroots level, and it has made a significant investment in the program. But this is more than simply asking women to promote Trek. The company is actively seeking feedback, criticism, and opinion so they can ensure future bike and product design actually reflects the wants and needs of female cyclists. So I'm not real sure. We have this conversation off and on as to how important it is to focus on women specifically as opposed to people riding. I guess we shall have to see. If you'd like to read this article, it is quite lengthy. It is interesting. It is by, I hope I can pronounce his name correctly, Aoif Glass, A-O-I-F-E. Interesting name. October 4th, Bike Radar. So that's our news for this week. I am going to take another quick break, and we will be back to talk with Dr. Michael Charney about the Dutch Reach. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, Visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. We are heading over to the East Coast to speak with Michael Charney about this concept, the Dutch Reach. We'll let him tell you all about it. Michael, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
A pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, well, it's my pleasure. You gave up your car back in 1992.
90. Actually, it gave up on me.
Oh,
but it's just as well.
Oh, so that's how you came to the decision. The car said, you're done.
Well, I was quite happy with that. It was basically rotting on the sidewalk anyway, or on the side of the street.
You actually live in a place where there are a lot of cyclists. You live in Cambridge, Mass., and there are a lot of cars. How well do cars and bicycles get along where you are?
Well, first of all, I should explain. So I started biking here in like 94 when I arrived. And there weren't so many bicycles on the road in those days. The cars had taken over. The streets, which had been two-way, became one-way, and basically parking lots for cars overnight and so forth. Over the years, and particularly in the last 5 or 8 years, there's just been a boom. In the old days, one could park almost anywhere, always find a post or meter or something, and now you're fighting for bicycle parking space. The high school keeps trying to build more, put out more and more bike racks. I mean, there are like 300 bike racks there. There's a stretch between Porter Square and Inman Square, where the woman got killed, which we'll talk about later, where there are 400 cars go through an hour during rush hour and 400 bicycles.
Wow.
We are turning into Little Holland here.
I like that. I like that a lot, and I'll bet you like it.
But I do, but there is strength and safety in numbers, but there are risks, too, and the drivers are not fully happy with our presence.
No, and they aren't in a lot of places. So early this month, September, Steve Anier of the Boston Globe published an article titled, "To Avoid Doorings, Cyclists Want Drivers to Do the Dutch Reach." Well, anybody who read it, everybody read it, because I had yoga students, I had people on Facebook, everybody going, did you read this? Did you read that? I'm like, yeah, I've read it like 20 times now. So you were cited as hoping to make it a practice among drivers. Explain what the Dutch Reach is.
Okay, so there's a little quiz. So you're sitting in your car, if you own one, and you're the driver. Which hand do you use to open the car door?
I would say 90% of the people will say 95%. I use my left hand because it's right there, correct?
Well, of course. In fact, the number is probably a whole lot higher, at least by my informal polling. Maybe things are different where you are. And then you say, oh, really? Do you know that the Dutch do it differently? And then they look at you really strange. And you then say, well, what they do, instead of using their left hand to open the car door, well, by the way, have you ever heard of dooring or being doored? And you ask them that question, and they say, if they live in Boston, the drivers themselves have had near bike experiences as opposed to near door experiences when they step out of the car. It's a mutually destructive habit. To use your same hand, near hand, to open the car door. So what the Dutch arrived at, someone did about 50 years ago in Holland, you use your opposite hand, your far hand. Now look, if you sit there and you reach with your far hand over to grab the car handle door, you're swiveling your upper torso. And you're positioning your body so it's perfectly natural to look out and out. You pass the mirror, you can see the mirror at least, and then you're looking straight out. And then you're looking back. It's very easy to look back and see oncoming cars. So that was called a common sense habit. They didn't have a name for it. They just did it. And if you ask the same question to the Dutch, they say, well, of course, you use your far hand. Use your right hand to open the car door if you're the driver. Well, actually, it's common sense to them to use the right hand. It is common sense, so-called, to us to use the left. But their thoughtless method of opening car doors is far safer than our thoughtless method. So I'm just suggesting we swap.
Just such a simple idea, and it makes so much sense. There is a new website up called DutchReach.org, and you're actually saying that the Dutch teach their kids about this way of exiting their cars when they're little. Parents teach their kids, and schools teach their kids.
This has been a little bit of a matter of controversy on this side of the Atlantic. As to what they actually do on the other side of the Atlantic in Holland. And the best as we've been able to determine, and there have been articles in the New York Times in 2011, in the Boston Globe in 2013, I've spoken to people directly, and I've looked at comments on a post called the Nudge blog, which carried the New York Times 2011 Russell Shorto piece in 2011, and they quoted it, and in the comment section afterwards, there were some people who disputed whether it was actually taught or not, and so forth and so on. But I've spoken to lots of people otherwise, people in the biking. I'm in the biking community, or in the active transport community, traffic safety people, I've corresponded by email, and they say yes. In fact, it's perfect common sense, and you really hardly have to teach it because if you're in the car with your small kid and the kid's in the car seat or whatever, they see that you are exiting the car using your opposite hand.
Sure, they learn from an early age.
There's practically no reason to teach it in school, I guess, but. It is on their driver's education curriculum in some way. At least it's taught in most, I gather, in most of Holland, and it is on the exam in a fair part of Holland. So I can't say absolutely what's happening in Holland, and even the Dutch who I've spoken to, there's been some, you know, it depends who you are and what, I guess, whether you're a city liver or a country liver, I don't know. But it is the predominant practice. It's been present according to Hans Voortnecht of Crow, CROW.NL, who is a transport manager or expert there, and used to be part of the another organization that's been very big in bikes in Holland. I'm sure some of your listeners know about it. And he said it's been used for 50 years. It's total common sense. Nobody's given it a second thought. People are surprised to learn it's not used elsewhere. Just like we're surprised to hear that they do it differently, and it's part of the culture. He sent me copies of the Dutch law or regulations that govern it. I've got it on that website, DutchReach.org. If you go to advocacy tools, and there's a thing called Dutch law and culture, and you get two documents. One is frequently asked questions, and that's really his version of what's practiced there and how long it's been practiced and what their attitude is about it. And the other is the legislation or the regulations. I'm not sure what it is. It's in Dutch. He provided his own translation. So I believe it's real.
It looks pretty real. I don't speak Dutch and I don't read Dutch, but it looks like a real document. And there is documentation. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dr. Michael Charney. He is a bicycle advocate advocating the Dutch Reach, which is use your right hand to exit your car.
If you're the driver. And if you're a passenger, you use whichever is your furthest hand. You're forced, if you automatically twist your torso, twist your body around, swivel around so you're looking out and you're easily able to look back.
So this isn't just for the driver. You're suggesting that everybody in the car, regardless of whether you're on the driver's or passenger side, use your opposite hand to exit the vehicle.
That's exactly right. And the reason is this, not to mention the fact that in Britain they sit on the opposite side when they drive. But the real reason is here, and particularly in our dense older cities where we used to have cow paths and horse paths, and now we have parking lots, that when you have parallel parked cars on the right as you bike, the door opens, of course, from the bicycle's right. But sometimes cars stop in the middle of the street, and they pop out from the passenger side of the driver's side. And then you get the word from the left-hand side. And so you want the passengers to use the same caution, and it just depends on which side of the car you're sitting on when you decide to leave the car. So it's a bilateral, you know, there's an asymmetry here, but you use the same general concept, the forehand.
The article that Steve wrote suggested that you're starting a quote-unquote grassroots campaign. So what are you doing to disseminate this information, and how is it being received?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to go all the way with you there. I'm starting what I'm hoping is a multi-level campaign. So the grassroots part is getting the message out to the general public, and particularly the bike public. We cyclists are the ones with the most skin in the game.
It's an interesting way of couching it.
Yes, and sometimes we end up skinless.
Right, exactly.
We are the ones who are going to get injured and killed, and it's our bikes that are going to get trashed, and the drivers are going to run off, hit and run anyway. So, and you're not going to get much justice, frankly, or sympathy from a jury of drivers, because you shouldn't have been on the road anyway, right?
Right, of course.
So at one level, I want as many cyclists to know this, because we are the ones who are the person down in this, and we've got the most at stake, and we drive, we're passengers, we've got families, we've got coworkers, and we should be the ones who are basically spreading the word upward and outward. And so I want every cyclist, every urban cyclist certainly, to know about this and to think that it really, for their own safety and that of their family and friends and children, to spread the word and teach it and use it until it becomes automatic. And then you don't even have to think about it. You're automatically looking back at what's coming on, what oncoming traffic is when you're a driver. And you shared it with your kids and everyone else. So that's the infantry, let's put it. I hate to use military terms, but what else? But at the same time, this is really something that ultimately we want it to be baked into the society. We want this to be part and parcel, just like in Holland, how people get out of their cars, that they're paying attention to bikes or to skateboards or, you know, electrified this or that, or motor scooters that are screaming along next to them. So we want to get it into driver's education. We want to get it into the kids when they are in bicycle training classes in elementary school, when they're doing their bike, when they're learning how to bike between cones and things. I don't know if it's still done, but it was for me, where you got some elementary education and had it. But you should then at the same time be told, you know, and when you're in the car, this is what you and your parents and your brothers and sisters should be doing. And I tell you, there's nothing better than having kids nagging their parents and their brothers and sisters to get behavior to change. I mean, it happens with smoking, it's happened with recycling. You just get the kids to start being nags, and 8-year-olds are terrific at this.
Yeah, they really are. They're better than most teachers in that regard.
Yeah. Well, they like rules. I mean, a lot of them like rules. It's when they turn 13, things change.
Well, that's true.
But so that's the infantry, or that's the ground root. And, you know, that's where this thing should start and probably is starting. I mean, probably it's the bicyclists who are paying attention to this if they're getting it. The next level, to get it ultimately into the schools, we want, you know, to get the school committees to say we want this done, to get the parent teachers associations to send messages out to parents and say, look, you know, you're dropping your kids off at school out of your cars. When you open those car doors, make sure there aren't any bikes around, because there are going to be more and more kids biking to school over the years now. Again, I mean, when I grew up, I biked to school, but then cars came in and bikes went out. Nobody lets the kids bike, or you have to fight to get, you know. So that's the level at the local level. You go on to talk, you start talking to your local city councilors and town councilors and your school committee, and you try to get this introduced. You try to get the local fire department, police department, public works department to teach all their drivers to use this so that it becomes standard practice. At the same time, you're going to start working, and this is the other thing. We bicycle activists and know this, but the general bike public needs to start pestering our coalitions if they don't naturally do it, if they're just focused. I certainly want engineered solutions. I'd love to have separate bike paths and so forth, but that's never going to cover the whole city and never in time for the next accident, for the next death. And it may be not really that much faster to change behavior everywhere, but we should be doing both. And so the next level is to get our organizations to be doing, putting this up on Facebook, putting it on Twitter, and getting everyone to look at that video, get the people who really want to work on it to go to the website and pick up some of the information there and some of the materials. I got a flyer you could adapt, and there are a lot of arguments there about why it's better than what we do. I mean, actually, I should just mention that. If you use your forehand, you can't. It's much harder to fling that door open.
Right.
And when you do open it, you can't push it all the way out. So it's only going to kind of nudge out initially. So that's those are both advantages. And the third advantage is when you step out, if your hand is still on the handle, you're going to be actually facing backwards.
Which is exactly what you want.
It's exactly what you want. And the more you do it, the more habitual it becomes. And then by the time it's totally second nature. And you're automatically respecting the fact that there's oncoming traffic and there are bicycles and things like that. So basically, the business about look out for bikes, you're programming this into your muscles, basically. It's just becoming part and parcel of who you are. You're always on the lookout now for bikes because you just have this habit, and you're aware that they exist. So the last thing is to get the state.
Yeah, of course.
To pass legislation to open up the driver's education manual to start including much more. Really, most states, as far as I understand, say from Richard Fries, who's here at Mass Bicycle Coalition, who's our statewide coalition. Is that, you know, they haven't, I don't know, when's the last time they changed the manual? But we're having a revolution. We're having a revolution,
right,
in biking in certain cities in this country, the older, denser cities that don't have, lots of malls and lots of off-street parking and big open boulevards. And room to put in bike, really separate bike lanes. So basically, it's our chance. If we can wedge open the RMV, DMV, get our state legislatures to say, look, you know, times are changing. We're going forward to bicycling again. We have to because of the climate. We ought to because of our health. We definitely need to protect the safety of our young, middle-aged, millennials and so forth, those of us who are commuting to work and rather not sit in cars in traffic breathing fumes. Right now it's much faster to go by bike in Cambridge at rush hour. There's no rush in rush hour here if you're in a car.
Yeah, right.
Which is probably why the drivers are so angry at us. So basically we've got to get the legislature to open the door of the Department of Transportation and the RMV, DMV, and change the driver's manual, incorporate all sorts of good bike safety concepts. And at this, I should mention something. This effort, when I started researching it right after a young woman was killed about five blocks from where I live in one of the most dangerous intersections in Cambridge, young woman, 27-year-old nursing student and barista in Somerville, came around behind an SUV, hit the door that was open, and ended up under a landscaping truck and died. This was June the 23rd. June the 24th, I read the comments section in the newspaper after Steve Anier and another person covered the actual accident. And some bike person was commenting among all the trolls who were trashing us for daring to be on the street and getting what we deserved and so forth. And he said, well, you know, the judge do it differently. And I followed the link to this Nudge blog, the one that cites the New York Times article by Russell Shorto, which is fresh bread and bicycling in the Netherlands or something like that. And you can find it on the website, DutchReach.org. And there it was. And I must say, as upset as I was about her death, I was even more upset to realize that we could have prevented it had we started this process 5, 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, but you can only do what you can do in the moment. So it's moving forward now. Are you getting feedback? I mean, are people starting to look at it? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, let's take some what they call analytics. Okay, so Stephen did a story. The next thing that happened, a couple days later, unbeknownst to me, outside Magazine Online, or Outside Online Magazine, which is one of these, you know, outdoor adventure, hiking, climbing, jumping, or parachuting off of, you know, tall buildings, whatever they do, picked up the story. It was a young man named Ben Fox, a young writer who, formerly of Boston, would follow the Globe from afar. This is Santa Fe, where they're based now. He'd moved out there. And he pitched the story to his editors, and they loved it. They loved it. And not only did he do a story, the editorial team is doubles as a video team or a production group, and they did a video, the video that's now out.
Wow.
So out of nowhere comes this fabulously fun and very accurate video. And if no one has seen it, this is like You could not ask for better. Okay, so now to analytics. Is it receptive? Is it being received well? So it went up a week ago. Last night on YouTube, when I started, first looked at it, like 8 or 9,000. Later in the evening, it was like 10. By the time I went to bed, it was 12. And the next morning, it was like 24. And right now, it's like 35 or more. 1,000.
Holy smokes.
Then I get an email from Ben Fox, out in Santa Fe, from online, which put the video up. And they've got their own feed. And as of, I don't know, 11:30 today, 233,000 views of the video.
Well, I guess that answers my question.
Yeah. So it basically, but, you know, that's only 0.1% of all the drivers in the United States.
That's a hell of a lot more than you had 24 hours ago.
And it's the YouTube one is seems to be increasing like a couple thousand every couple of hours.
That's great.
But the so what happened next was that there's a wonderful reporter named Marco Werman.
Oh, I know Marco Werman from The World.
That's right, BBC The World. It's based here in Austin, which is part of Boston. And his man, Bradley Campbell, calls me up. And turns out he's been to Holland. He knows about the reach. He's a bicyclist. He loves the issue. And I go in on Monday. I did an interview. That's now up to go to PRI Dutch Reach, and you will hear like a beautiful five-minute segment, I must say. He put it at the very end where it was the feel-good story of the day after the usual array of sorrow, disaster, and good music. And that linked to the video that on Outside Online did. And so that went to 300 stations around the North America. So that's why we're getting 250,000, I bet, by now.
So you have created a really wonderful multi-headed monster.
I hope so.
I hope so, too. It's really awesome.
Before I get knocked off by some texting drunk driver.
I don't even want to go there. I don't even know. We live in the town where Shelley Snyder was hit at 60 miles an hour in Montana on her way from here to meet up with her fiancé. They just life-flighted her back to Cleveland. She actually is beginning to recover. But it was really, really, really scary. And she founded our bike advocacy group in Cleveland called Bike Cleveland. So, yeah, I am really well aware of how important all of these separate but connected issues are. We are running out of time. I really wish we could talk some more, and I will get back in touch with you on some things that are happening here in Northeast Ohio that maybe you'd be interested in participating in. And I really thank you for your time and for the work you're doing. It's awesome.
Well, let me thank you for taking me on your show.
Dr. Charney, Michael Charney, thank you so much for talking with me on the Outspoken Cyclist today.
This is terrific, Diane.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Michael Charney joined us from the East Coast to talk about the Dutch Reach idea. Wow. Just wow. I mean, how cool is that? I listen to Marco Werman on The World almost every single day when I'm in my car, not on my bike. And I just think it's awesome how this thing is just snowballing. It's just great. I'm not sure how quickly I can retrain my brain to open my car door with the opposite hand, but I think I'm going to try to do it. That's our show for this week. Thank you so much for listening. I'd like to thank our guests, Neil Flock from Link Bicycles and Cycle Monkey, Michael Charney from the Dutch Reach concept. I hope he gets more legs on this concept, and I hope that some of the local and state people will begin to adopt the ideas and get them down to the school level. That's, I think, where it needs to start. Remember, we will be at Recumbent CycleCon and the Bicycle Touring and Travel Expo in Sharonville tomorrow, Sunday. It's open from 10 to 4. If you're in the area, stop by and say hi. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you have a great week. If you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.